Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Stephen Rodriguez, a PhD candidate in history at Vanderbilt University and a host on the network. Today I'll speak with Juan Pablo Scarfi, the author of The Hidden History of International Law in the Americas, Empires and Legal Networks, published by Oxford University Press in 2017. In his book, Dr. Scarfi shows the central role of a coterie of elite Latin American jurists and intellectuals in constructing a Pan-American inflected conception of international law. In exploring the rise of so-called American international law, Scarfi's monograph contributes to a now burgeoning literature on the rise of global governance by showing how many of the legal ideas that came to serve as the foundation of organizations like the United Nations were first experimented with in Latin America. While much of the previous work on international law during the 20th century has often left Latin America out of the picture or given it a peripheral role, this important monograph positions Latin America at the center of the development of modern ideas about international law and highlights the global legal networks that allowed for spirited exchanges between Latin American, North American, and European legal elites. In the conversation that follows, I'll talk to Dr. Scarfi for about 50 minutes about a number of aspects of his book. I'm here with Dr. Scarfi to talk about his book, The Hidden History of International Law in the Americas, Empires and Legal Networks. Thanks for taking the time to talk with me today, Dr. Scarfi.
Thank you very much for the invitation, Stephen.
I thought, as is customary here on the New Books Network, we'd like to start with a question about your background as a scholar and your training and how that kind of influenced the topic that you chose to research or any other kind of information that you think would be helpful in having us get a sense of your kind of intellectual genealogy.
I studied political science as an undergrad and did my master's in history in Argentina at Torquato di Tella University and completed my PhD at the University of Cambridge in the UK in politics and international studies. But my thesis had a strong historical focus on intellectual and international history. I have been always interested in the history of political thought and intellectual history and the Cambridge School of Political Thought. And I have been always interested in interdisciplinary research in history, political theory, and law, and especially the connections between history and theory. I had a long experience teaching history of political thought in Argentina, but also in Cambridge. And my master dissertation was my first contribution to the topic of the hidden history of international law in the Americas. In my master dissertation, I focused essentially on James Brown Scott, United States jurist and legal advisor of the U.S. Department, and the dissemination of U.S. international law in Latin America. My master thesis was published as a book. This was my first book. It was published in 2014 by Fondo de Cultura Económica, titled El Imperio de la Ley, James Brown Scott y la Construcción de un Orden Jurídico Interamericano. As I mentioned, this background in political theory and political thought was a central tool for my master's and doctoral research on the history of international law and the history of U.S.-Latin American relations. When I arrived to Cambridge, I had a very well-structured doctoral project and a strong background on recent scholarship in the history of international law and empire and the history of U.S.-Latin American relations. Cambridge, the University of Cambridge, proved to be a very suitable environment to do interdisciplinary research in the history of international law, political thought, the history of international relations, U.S. and Latin American history. And especially, I find it a suitable environment, the Department of Politics and International Studies, the Center of Latin American Studies, and the History Faculty. I came across the work of many new scholars and also enhanced my knowledge on the Cambridge School and the history of political thought, global history, the English School of International Relations, important debates that my book covers on the relationship between liberalism and empire, and U.S. and Latin American history, of course. While I was at Cambridge, of course, I did archival research on the American Institute of International Law, a central subject of the book, and I spent 3 months in 2011 at Columbia University as a visiting scholar, conducting research at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace Archives, and had the chance to meet several scholars in these fields when I was there doing archival research. I think this is a good overview of my trajectory.
Yeah, thank you. That's great. I mean, I think that, and hopefully we talk about this more later, but I mean, your interdisciplinary background, I think, really comes across in the book, the way you're able to weave together legal history, intellectual history to an extent, international relations. I mean, I think it's one of my favorite parts of the book is the way it's able to move between those different domains. But I thought first we would start with a kind of more basic but important concept or idea that underpins your book, which is Pan-Americanism. A lot of listeners might be familiar with Pan-Americanism, but for those who aren't, I was wondering if you could kind of give a basic description of what Pan-Americanism is, the kind of tensions that existed within it, which you very skillfully explore throughout the book, and how its meaning came to change over time through these international legal networks and the conversations and disputes that occurred.
Yeah, well, that's a very central question, I suppose, and this is part of the largest history of that the book covers. Pan-Americanism was central to the history of U.S. Latin American foreign relations in the early 20th century, and of course, can be considered as a central language in the foundations of the Inter-American system as such in its foundational period. What was Pan-Americanism? One can define Pan-Americanism in its early stages, that is to say in the 1890s, as a policy or a U.S. policy of economic, political, cultural, legal cooperation towards Latin America. So it was a U.S.-led policy. The term was invented in the United States in the early 1880s, yes. But of course, Pan-Americanism also was and can be considered as David Shane suggests as the friendly face of U.S. hegemony in Latin America. Pan-Americanism had this a central U.S.-led feature in this in the late 19th century, but in the beginning of the 20th century, and especially after Elihu Root visited the South American countries in the context of the Third Pan-American Conference in Rio de Janeiro in 1906, Pan-Americanism began to be redefined, and began to be redefined by a series of important diplomats and legal scholars from Latin America. Essentially, Joaquim Nabuco, a diplomat who worked at the Brazilian embassy in the United States and had a strong relationship with a close relationship, a friendship actually with Elihu Root, contributed to redefine Pan-Americanism along the lines of a multilateral language of inter-American relations. And essentially, many Pan-Americanist lawyers, diplomats, and possibly the most important one was Alejandro Álvarez, a central character in the book, who was a Chilean prominent international lawyer, legal advisor of the Chilean Foreign Minister of Foreign Affairs, and also a very prominent jurist who studied in Paris and founded the Institute, the Haute Études International in Paris, and a very influential figure who also became then later a judge of the International Court of Justice. And Alejandro Álvarez began to use, and this, there are previous precedents of this in Joaquín Nabucco, but essentially what these international lawyers, and we can also include Luis María Drago from Argentina, Foreign Ministry of Foreign Affairs, also associated to the Drago Doctrine, these jurists began to redefine traditional principles of foreign policy, such as the Monroe Doctrine, in a language that sought to redefine U.S. principles as a hemispheric common language of international law. And essentially what Álvarez did was to use a U.S. language such as the Monroe Doctrine and redefine this language along the lines of a common American international law. This, of course, implied a redefinition of the Monroe Doctrine, which was essentially a unilateral principle, as a hemispheric a principle of international law. And this principle could contribute not just to protect the Americas from European interventions, but also moderate U.S. interventions in Latin America by developing a language of solidarity and cooperation between the United States and Latin America. After the visit of Eli Roth, Alejandro Álvarez and a series of international lawyers from South America contributed to redefine Pan-Americanism as a common language that also could contribute to moderate U.S. intervention. And actually, there were different positions also within the United States. And essentially, Eli Roth was the one who clearly engaged with these visions. And that's why he renovated Pan-Americanism along the lines of these redefinitions that were being advanced by Latin American lawyers and diplomats. So there's an important shift after 1906, and also especially after the Latin American delegations gained their seats in the Second Peace Conference in 1907, and Eli Roth played a central role in this regard. And in this sense, after the Second Peace Conference, we see an important engagement of international lawyers and diplomats from Latin America, and we can also include Ruy Barbosa here as well, with the language of Pan-Americanism and American international law, that is to say, a common language of international law for the Americas. And the Monroe Doctrine and Pan-Americanism played a central role in redefining a common language of diplomacy and international law in the Americas.
That's a very helpful overview. Thank you. And I wanted to just focus a little bit more on something you said, though, about the you trace the kind of shifts in this legal language or this legal discourse of Pan-Americanism very effectively throughout the book. And one thing that is a persistent thing that you look at is the change, the ethnocentric nature of a lot of this discourse. So I was wondering maybe you could, if we focus first on these two figures that you spend a lot of time, or let's say three figures, you have James Brown Scott, the American lawyer, Alejandro Álvarez, and later on in the book, you're looking at the Cuban lawyer, Antonio Bustamante. Yeah. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the kind of ethnocentric assumptions that some of these figures had in their conceptualization of hemispheric law.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point. I suppose the important members of the American Institute. And it's worth mentioning that Antonio Sánchez de Bustamante, once the American Institute of International Law, which was funded by the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and I think this is worth mentioning, and it was originally based in Washington, and there was a shift when Antonio Sánchez de Bustamante, in close alliance with James Brown Scott, they decided to had the chair of the American Institute in Cuba. And when they decide to relocate the American Institute in Cuba, there were certain shifts that led eventually to displace Alejandro Álvarez as Secretary General of the American Institute of International Law. And I think this is traced in the book, and I think that this is an important episode in the shifts of these ethnocentric visions that began to have more influence within the American Institute. The American Institute was founded by Alejandro Álvarez and James Brown Scott along the lines of a common vision of American international law. But within the American Institute, there was a shared conception which was very much a U.S.-led conception of international law, in the sense that certain U.S.-led principles of U.S. hegemony and U.S. leadership were considered as a part of a common language of American international law, and these create a sort of a common a grammatic language of international law. All the international lawyers within the American Institute, Bustamante, Álvarez, and Scott, shared the idea that the Monroe Doctrine was central to the development of American international law, Pan-American solidarity, hemispheric peace. But an essential question, which was a shared vision within the American Institute, is none of the members of the American Institute questioned the Platt Amendment, which gave the United States the right to intervene on a regular basis, as problematic for Latin American countries. And there were also certain common formal shared visions about a certain kind of common ground of formal adherence to certain principles such as sovereign equality among states, the condemnation of violent and arbitrary interventions. And also, which were formal principles that most of the international lawyers within the American Institute shared, but there was also a condescending attitude with the idea that there was all these international lawyers sort of believed that there should be a right to protect the lives and properties of foreigners located abroad, and these had implications for U.S. companies and U.S. citizens located in Latin American countries. So there was a common set of shared visions according to which a U.S. language was central and was key to the American Institute. The ethnocentric visions emerged when James Brown Scott created these strong alliances with Bustamante, when the Institute was relocated in Cuba. And essentially, these contributed to create a code of international law that had to be based on the technocratic recommendation of a selected elite, rather than a code that should be discussed by all the diplomats of the Western Hemisphere. And this ethnocentric vision of the U.S. Language of international law as a model for the code of international law for the Americas as a whole came from Scott, but it also creates some sort of alliances among important members of the American Institute. And Bustamante engaged with the idea that the code of international law had to be based on the expertise of a technocratic legal elite, and it shouldn't be discussed as a political code that would represent the different traditions of legal languages of the Americas. And the discussion that emerged within the American Institute of International Law had to do with these two confronted visions. On the one hand, we had Álvarez, who believed that it was possible to combine a Latin American language of international law and U.S. language into a common Pan-American language. This was very much a Hegelian vision, but still was a multilateral vision, according to which when creating a code, it was important to take into account very seriously the legal traditions of all the countries of Latin America. Certain international lawyers push even further about these questions, such as Carlos Saavedra Lamas, as a character mentioned in the book, in the final chapter, the Argentine Foreign Minister of Foreign Affairs. But the United States, Charles Evan Hughes, Secretary of State, and James Brown Scott had the vision that the code should be based on the expertise and should be elaborated by a selected elite. And this what led to the second conference of Rio de Janeiro, a codification meeting of 1927. And in this context, Alejandro Álvarez prepared a series of projects. And within a legal elite a large group of jurists, but in the context of a conference of legal experts, there was an important lawyer within was part of the American Institute, who believed that the principle of non-intervention was essential for creating the code and pushed for the code to include a very strong vision about non-intervention. This was the treasurer of the American Institute, Luis Anderson. And Luis Anderson pushed for this code to include an absolute notion of non-intervention. And when the code was discussed afterwards in the context, of a political conference in the Pan-American Conference of Havana in a year later in 1928, there was a very confrontational debate in this conference between Charles Evan Hughes and Victor Manuel Maurtua, who was an important member of the American Institute, also very well connected with Scott and Antonio Bustamante, and they pushed to include certain scope for maintaining the right to intervene and U.S. right to interventions as part of this code of American international law. And this led eventually to a confrontation between an ethnocentric but also an elitist conservative vision that considered that the code had to be built on the basis of the expertise of a technocratic elite. And in this sense, it's interesting and it's worth mentioning that Bustamante and Scott had as a model the Lieber Code that was implemented in the United States in the context of the Civil War. And in this sense, the idea was that it was the mission of a series of experts to create a code for a whole hemisphere. And this, of course, created a great deal of resistance among various groups of Latin American diplomats at Havana. And at Havana, because of this confrontation between an ethnocentric vision, I would say also a radical anti-interventionist vision, and a more solidarist vision, such as the one defended by Álvarez, created a great deal of confrontation between a U.S.-led ideas of codification and creating an American international law very much rooted on the U.S. model and a technocratic elite, and a series of visions that put forward the idea that it was important to politicize international law and to include a pluralist approach that would include the different codes, traditions, and visions of the different countries of Latin America as part of a common code that should be, for that reason, discussed politically and not as a technocratic recommendation of a small group of experts.
On this point of the tension between pluralism and anti-pluralism, legal pluralism and anti-pluralism, I was wondering, you cite a number of works in the book coming out of the tradition of law in European empire, books like The Gentle Civilizer of Nations, and I'm trying to understand. I know in your more recent work in an article, you are trying to position Latin America as kind of the center of some of these developments in international law. When I think many people, there's been a tradition, an unfortunate tradition, the scholarship to concentrate on Europe, have a Eurocentric conception of this. But In what ways were Latin American legal elites influenced by this civilizing discourse that had been a very central feature of a lot of European international law and European empire? How were they kind of adapting some of that, or perhaps pushing back against this civilizational discourse, or adapting it for their own circumstances? What kind of connection do you see there? Do you see a great deal of a kind of a shared language of civilizing discourse between Latin American legal elites and European legal elites?
Well, that's an interesting question, because what I try to emphasize in this article, and I'm glad that you mentioned it, because that article was meant to be part of my doctoral thesis, and that is to say the book that is emerged from it, and decided not to include this because this group of pluralist lawyers that I include as part of the characters of this article published at the Leiden Journal of International Law very recently, they were outside the habitus and the establishment of the main establishment of the legal elites that were the dominant network of international lawyers within the Western Hemisphere, and those who push for this anti-imperialist legal vision were at the margins of this legal network that I describe in the book, the American Institute of International Law. Within the legal elites, we find that the standard of civilization was extremely important, and that's why I think most of the international lawyers who engaged with the American Institute and were deeply attached to the American Institute did not confront the idea or the civilizing mission and the principle of the standard of civilization to the extent that they adopt, and this is the case of Alvarez, that they agreed to adopt a U.S.-led language to create a common idea of American international law. And I think that's that is revealing of the extent to which a sort of language of U.S. leadership was essential for building a civilizing mission or integrating a common vision, or sort of trying to legitimize a common vision of American international law in the Western Hemisphere by redefining a principle that was originally a U.S. unilateral principle. The fact that Alvarez never confronted the Platt Amendment and was especially condescending with it is also telling of the extent to which these international lawyers within the American Institute believed that it was important to create some sort of civilizing mission according to which the leadership of the United States would contribute to create the grounds for advancing the principles of civilization and extending and pan-Americanizing the standard of civilization across Latin America. In that sense, we can consider very much this as a civilizing mission. Alejandro Alvarez, who's a central character, of course, he sought to moderate by advancing this civilizing mission. He sought to moderate, create grounds for moderating U.S. intervention. But at the same time, he considered that U.S. hegemony was beneficial because it would create the grounds for civilizing all the Americas according to the language that the United States was creating. This also emerged out when the beginning of the First World War, when the United States became neutral, also Latin American countries began to engage with neutrality, and South American countries engaged with the leadership, with sort of following the leadership of the United States in being neutral at the beginning, of course, of the First World War. And Alejandro Alvarez saw that as the idea that the United States was the leader of neutral countries, peaceful countries, countries that would advance the legal settlements of international disputes, that would create grounds for principles of solidarity in opposition to European countries that were leading to this war, that were also having these imperial confrontations, that would sort out disputes through the balance of power. The Americas were the leaders, but the United States should create the path as a leader that, so that the Latin American countries should follow that path. And Alejandro Valdez was very explicit about this in his book published in the context of the First World War, Le Droit International de l'Avenir, El Derecho Internacional del Porvenir, The International Law of the Future. In that book, he was explicit of the fact that Latin American countries should follow the path of the United States. In that sense, also the idea that U.S. legal values and U.S. legal traditions were the model, there was an idea that there was part, and this would create grounds for a civilizing mission for the Americas, and sharing the idea that the United States was a model was implied a strong belief in the importance of creating some sort of civilizing mission along the lines of U.S. legal and political values, traditions, and institutions. Of course, the U.S. Constitution and the federal model of the United States and the U.S. Declaration of Independence, especially for Scott, was a model for creating also the declaration that he created on the Declaration of the Rights and Duties of Nations. That was the first declaration of the American Institute of International Law. So in that sense, the idea that the United States was a model, it was much stronger in Scott, but it was still very strong in an international lawyer who had a more solidarist approach, such as Alvarez. And I think that this civilizing mission in the Western Hemisphere, a U.S. model was key to these international lawyers, especially Alvarez and Victor Manuel Murtua from Peru and Antonio Sanchez de Bustamante from Cuba.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
You've mentioned the Platt Amendment a couple of times, and of course the Platt Amendment is the series of articles appended to the Cuban Constitution that gave the U.S. these sweeping powers to intervene for a number of reasons. And I was kind of just struck by how central the Platt Amendment is to a lot of the legal precedent and thinking of these lawyers. But I wanted to see if you could talk a little bit about that. But more specifically, Cuba, it plays a very important role, as you've kind of already alluded to, in the construction of American international law. And you have figures like Antonio Sanchez Bustamante, who are firm allies of lawyers like Scott. But I was wondering, but on other levels, Cuba is also central. It is a physical center. It's the place where one of the journals is published. So Cuba on a number of levels is a really key part of this story, which, I'm someone who studies Cuba, and this was very interesting to me to see how central Cuba was in Pan-Americanism. But Could you explain a bit more about why Cuba was so important for the U.S. to be able to sort of try to gain some kind of legitimacy within Latin American law? Why were they so focused on making Cuba the place where so many of these important events and publications were published? And
That's a very good question. And I think that here comes the geopolitical dimension of the book. I try to emphasize that, and this, of course, emerged in the conclusions of the book, but I try to emphasize in the book the extent to which international lawyers, and especially Scott, had a geopolitical mindset. He believed that Cuba would be the center of international law of the future. So at some point in the book, I suggest that whereas Alvarez believed that some sort of imaginary Pan-American location would be the ideal place, so the sky, if you like, or a Hegelian vision of idealized terrain where all these lawyers should create a new island where they would discuss in a transnational a sphere, which is very much ideal or idealized in Alvarez. But for Scott, it was clear that that island should be Cuba. And he believed that Cuba should be the new, well, actually there were plans, and I mentioned this in the book, there were clear plans to create a palace of justice, such as the one at The Hague, to create a palace of justice and also an inter-American court of justice in Cuba. I mean, these projects were not effective, and especially because Murray Butler, the president of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, did believe that it was not worth investing on creating a new palace of justice in Cuba. In the context of the late 1920s, when there was a critical context in Cuba, of course, and it was problematic. But it also was problematic because Murray Butler was more conscious about the fact that centralizing in Cuba a very US-led vision of international law would be problematic and would be confronted by a series of South American and international lawyers across Latin America. Murray Butler was more conscious about the fact that anti-imperialist ideologies were emerging in Latin American countries. Scott sort of overlooked these visions. He was part of a legal elite that to some extent, was completely could live a happy life ignoring and overlooking this resistance that a U.S.-led vision and creating a center of international law in Cuba would be problematic and would be resisted by a great number of diplomats in Latin America, and especially if it was funded exclusively by the United States. So this led to a discussion within the Carnegie Endowment that funded the American Institute of International Law. But still this geopolitical vision that Cuba could be the proper place for the international law of the future was strong in Scott. And also, of course, Bustamante very much engaged with these projects, and so did Victor Manuel Murtua, who was a close ally with the government of Leguía in Peru at the moment, and there was a kind of a triangle of alliance in the context of the Havana Conference between Peru, Cuba, and the United States. But of course, these projects of creating were very much pushed by these three figures of creating a palace of justice and creating a big center of international law of the American Institute funded by the Carnegie and in Cuba in Havana it was a project that was key at the moment but of course, the political circumstances were not appropriate, and Scott and Victor Manuel Murtua had to confront, and at some point when the situation was so critical, they were forced to recognize that it was impossible in Cuba because student protests and a critical situation in Cuba led them to recognize that it was impossible to create a center of international law. But the idea was of creating a center of international law, but it was very much shaped by the United States. And of course, in this context, at some point, Scott suggested to Bustamante that he should be the president of the American Institute, and Bustamante declined the offer because he believed that the best president should, the best possible president of the Institute, even though if it were to be located in Havana, should be always be Scott. But these projects were important and had to do with ethnocentric vision of Cuba as a center of the U.S. Imperial imagination. And we have to take into account also that Scott was a soldier in the context of the Spanish, U.S., American Spanish War in 1898. And he had in his mindset, Cuba was some sort of friendly country of the United States. And he believed that Cuba was to some extent an extension of the United States in the legal mindset of Scott. And that's why locating in Cuba a center of international law was so central in his legal mindset.
That provides a great segue to my next question, which is kind of also about Cuba, but kind of gets us to a later part of your book when we're looking at the good neighbor policy era. And If I have my history correct, it's in 1933, the good neighbor policy is announced in FDR's inaugural. And then we have the Cuban Revolution of 1933, which I guess provides a very early test case to see if the U.S. would be able to actually deliver on this rhetoric. And in the book, as you kind of trace, I guess, to an extent, the decline of the AIL with this shift to what you call inter-American period. At least certainly a rhetorical shift, but this is actually my question is that, well, first, maybe just explain what inter-Americanism was, but more so, I'd like to know if you think that, to what extent was it a rhetorical shift versus an actual kind of reality that actually affected the fundamental nature of U.S. Latin American relations?
I think that's a good question. I think, of course, what I was just mentioning before, the idea that it was possible to create a legal center of international law in Cuba, failed as a project in part because the push for my reading of the emergence of inter-American multilateralism and the good neighbor had to do to some extent with the push that we see in 1933 of a series of Latin American international lawyers, but also economists in Mexico and diplomats in Argentina. Essentially, Carlos Saavedra Lamas is a key figure in this regard. So there is a sort of idea that the Pan-American movement, as it emerged on the basis of a U.S.-led vision, should be redefined along the lines of a multilateral language. And the push of Latin Americans for adopting the principle of non-intervention was key to this story. And I sort of think, I try to suggest in the book that a Latin American agency we can discuss further whether that had implications for a decline of U.S. hegemony. That's another discussion. But there is a shift, and this shift was pushed by a series of diplomats from South America, but also from Mexico. They were pushing for a long time for the principle of not, for adopting the principle of non-intervention. One of many of these fields have to do with those who were, as already mentioned, outside of the network of the American Institute and who were politicizing the principle of non-intervention that I cover in my article in Leiden Journal. Isidro Favela, Carlos Savera Lamas, who was also a diplomat at the Montevideo Conference in 1933. There was a push for adopting an inter-American system that would allow more agency to Latin American countries. And the push for non-intervention played also a central role. And the fact that Carlos Saavedra Lamas made that move that allowed him to put forward the anti-war treaty that he put forward in 1933 outside of the Pan-American system, and he put it as a South American anti-war treaty, and then he moved forward the treaty into the League of Nations. And when the all the American countries meet at Montevideo, he had the anti-war treaty as a fait accompli. So this implied that there was some sort of a more less hierarchical equilibrium of forces between the United States, at least in South American countries, in alliance with Mexico, I would say. So there is a shift in the United States felt it was, of course, more beneficial to at least engage with these ideas of non-intervention, and this would imply creating some sort of more cooperative principles. That also this allowed for the Pan-American movement to begin to be redefined as inter-Americanism. So we see the shift in language from Pan-Americanism to inter-Americanism in this context, and I think it has to do with this push of the anti-imperialists. Anti-imperialists that were outside the Pan-American movement, but also contributed to politicize the debates about intervention and non-intervention. And I think when these discussions about intervention, which essentially were confined to an elite of jurists, began to spread out across the Americas, among diplomats, but also among political parties. We have the APRA in Peru. The effects of the Mexican Revolution, of course, had to do with this the advancement of anti-imperialist visions. I think this politicization of international law, this politicization of the principle of non-intervention, contributed for creating of making of the international law debate a broader public debate of the Americas that had more political implications. And I think this contributed, or at least prompted the United States to move towards the good neighbor policy. So I see the good neighbor policy also as a reaction to a strong push from Latin American countries. When we look at the Montevideo Conference in 1933, it is clear that there was a push of Carlos Saavedra Lamas, Puig, also the influence of Isidro Favela, that I mentioned, who was a jurist, who was a legal advisor of the foreign minister for many, many years, and was also the diplomat of the Mexican Revolution in the context of Carranza. Carranza was president in Mexico and also contributed to the reform of the constitution in Mexico. Well, these figures played a central role, I think, in creating the grounds and prompting the United States have a commitment with the principle of non-intervention. And I think it's worth mentioning that after the good neighbor policy, we see a decline of anti-imperialist visions. All these international lawyers, political thinkers who were anti-imperialist, and the anti-imperialist ideologies began to decline. And I think it had to do with the fact that the United States committed with the principle of non-intervention. And that sort of contributed to the But then we have, a reemergence of anti-imperialist visions in the 50s and 60s with the Cuban Revolution, of course. But in the 30s and until the Second World War, we see a sort of golden period of inter-American cooperation, with certain degree of confrontation, of course. But I think in this regard, Latin American agency and the South American treaty advanced by Carlos Saavedra Lamas, and was essentially a diplomat, but also these anti-imperialist visions who contributed to politicize international law, both at the Havana Conference in 1928, but also at Montevideo. And this eventually contributed to push the United States to derogate the Platt Amendment. And this is something that we also see in the Montevideo Conference as a push of Latin American countries, especially South American countries and Mexico.
Great. As we kind of come to our last few minutes here, I want to sort of end, try to end where you end the book, which is, you know, in your conclusion, you have a section in which you're considering trying to relate Pan-Americanism and the changes to the rise of kind of globalism or global society. And of course, this is a topic that is right now kind of a burgeoning field. The work on global governance by people like Mark Mazower tracing the intellectual history, or Susan Peterson tracing the history of the League of Nations. But I was wondering, what is your, how do you see these earlier legal interactions between the U.S. and Latin America as relating to so-called global society or global governance that is typically framed as something that emerges in the following the end of World War II?
Well, I suppose that in the book, and this is an important question that you asked this, I suppose in the book I try to suggest that the experiments and the laboratory of what the United States did in Latin America with the creation of this series of, if you like, advancing disciplinary knowledge about certain fields in different disciplines about Latin America in geography, in international law, in political science, in history, contributed to create a Pan-American vision and ideas connecting disciplinary knowledge with the creation of some sort of hemispheric governance. And I think this is key to the, this was key to the early Pan-American movement, but also contributed to shape the global visions that emerged in the United States, essentially in the early 1940s. And we see this turn from, if you like, some scholars suggest that it's a turn from isolation to globalism or interventionism, or a turn from. But we can, I think, it's more fair to consider this shift as a shift from hemispherism into globalism. And I think the experiments that the United States did with the Pan-American movement, with early ideas of hemispheric governance in the fields of international law, as I said, also disciplinary knowledge was key to the Pan-American movement, disciplinary knowledge of Latin America, I think, and the fact that many of the early figures of the foundation of history, well, this is shown by Ricardo Salvatore's book, Disciplinary Knowledge. You see, we can see that the United States developed hemispheric knowledge, expert knowledge, and there was a connection between those who work for the State Department and those who work for these the emerging fields of history, geography, and international law. And I think the expertise of building this expert knowledge on international law contributed to create ideas of global governance, having the United States as model, but of course, bringing into the picture the Euro-ASEAN question, if you like, and developing more ambitious ideas of global governance. But still, and I think the work of Mark Mazower shows this very clearly, the United States was a strong model for creating the UN. What I think Mark Mazower's recent book does not show is the fact that Pan-Americanism played a central role in creating at least a laboratory for creating at least ideas of hemispheric governments. Of course, what we see in 1945 is that, and even in the early 40s, is that some of the Latin American, Pan-American figures such as Alvarez would continue to predicate Inter-Americanism, but Inter-Americanism wouldn't be a priority for the United States after the Second World War when building the UN. But so these figures were to some extent out of fashion. But still, even though they were out of fashion and some of those who predicate Inter-Americanist and hemispherist and would continue to do so in after the Second World War would be soundless, of course. But still, the previous experiment of what the United States did was essential for bringing into life the UN. And I think the fact that, of course, I don't talk very much in this book about the Central American Court of Justice, but that was also a key experiment that the United States did in Central America. And of course, creating this American Institute and a series of experiments in the legal field were essential for creating a model of global governance where, of course, international law was not opposed to the geopolitical imagination that emerged in 1945. And also, that's why I try to emphasize in the book, and I want to bring go back to something I already mentioned, is that the legalist vision, that usually a liberal internationalist legal vision such as that of Scott, had a strong connection with the geopolitical imagination. And we shouldn't see these visions as opposed and contradictory, but they were joined together in the 20s and in the plans of Scott and bringing into the picture the connections between a liberal international legal mindset and geopolitical more strategic imagination was present in these hemispheric designs that Scott had in mind in Cuba. And I think also because of the creation of the foundation of international relations as a discipline, there was a turn, or there was an idea that geopolitical and strategic visions of the Cold War were completely separate from legal visions. But there were strong connections. And I think the laboratory of what happened in Latin America can bring us a picture of the connections between legal mindset and geopolitical strategies. And I think Latin America was a big experiment. And that's why when we see the turn to globalism, we should take into account also these connections, the legal mindset and the geopolitical strategies that usually tend to be seen as contradictory and opposed to one another.
As a final question, I just wanted to see if you could speak, say a few words about what you're working on currently, if you're working on another book project or perhaps an article you're working on, just what are you currently working on?
Well, thank you. My current research project explores the origins of human rights and ideas and institutions in the Americas in the context of the early Cold War period. From the transformation of Pan-American Union into OAS to the early 70s. And this project focuses on primarily on the 60s and the connections actually between human rights and geopolitics, something I already mentioned just a minute ago. This project concentrates on the formation of the Inter-American Commission of Human Rights and the impact of the Cuban Revolution on the OAS in the early stages of the OAS. I just recently been awarded a Fulbright Fellowship and spent 3 months in Washington, D.C. at the Elliott School of International Affairs and George Washington University, conducting research on the OAS archives and the library, and return from the U.S. In February 2020, just a couple of months ago, and returned to Buenos Aires just before the beginning of the corona crisis pandemic. So this project stems from the hidden history and from my PhD project. I just completed the archival work, and I'm planning to publish a book monograph in the next few years, I hope. In the meantime, I'm working on an article basically exploring the origins of the Inter-American Commission of Human Rights. I gave a preliminary advance of this article. in a talk that I gave at Columbia University recently while I was at the US, and also in a talk I gave last year at Cambridge in 2019. And I'm also completing an edited volume on Pan-Americanism. I'm co-editing this edited volume on Pan-Americanism, tentatively entitled Pan-Americanism, the Structuring of Inter-American Relations. And just finally, just want to mention that I'm a currently a researcher at CONICET, it's the Argentine Research Council here in Argentina. And I've been running, along with a series of colleagues in Argentina here, we run a workshop on global history, and we're running this for 5 years. And the workshop in global history is based at the Universidad de San Andrés, where I'm a researcher and professor at the moment.
Great. Well, Dr. Scharfi, it's really been a pleasure to speak with you today. I enjoyed our discussion, and I just wanted to thank you again for talking.
Well, thank you very much for the invitation again.